In your retirement letter, you thanked the attorneys you've worked with over the years. You said, lawyers are the most interesting and humorous people in the world.
They are, indeed.
That might seem a little antithetical to some people. What did you mean by that?
I think when most people think of hiring a lawyer, they imagine the dispute that they're involved in and how upset or angry or scared they may be about that. They see a lawyer as someone, you know, with a sword and a shield going out to do battle for them. They think of them more as an intellectual warrior. In reality, I mean, lawyers have that function. They do represent clients. They are involved in dispute resolution. But lawyers are working with people, with humans, and with their problems. And the type of problems that lawyers tend to see can be relatively mundane, a simple business deal gone bad, or they can be incredibly complicated. They often have a basis, way more often than not, in incredibly poor judgment, especially decisions fueled by alcohol and drugs, you know, the mothers of poor judgment. They can find themselves clients in the most convoluted situations. When I have joked in the past about these anecdotes and case reports, things I've written up over the years, I can't make this stuff up. I used to refer to the book I was going to write, the working title, as Swimming in the Sea of Stupid. And every time I dive down and I look for the bottom, it's farther down than I thought I remembered it being, because people just can do the most odd things. So when you sit down with a group of lawyers and you start swapping stories about past cases, they're both sad because they're real problems, but they're also really sometimes incredibly humorous.
You know, I know you're supposed to have there's a certain relationship that a judge is supposed to have with lawyers that appear in your courtroom, and you are definitely the one in charge and the person in power. But I would imagine you work with a lot of these attorneys for several years, and you can't help but form relationships with them. Is that true?
It's a team effort. Judges don't resolve cases. Lawyers don't resolve cases. But judges and lawyers working together with juries and court administrators and friends of the court and support folks, you work together as a team within a set of processes and standards that have been outlined to get things done. And if you can rely on lawyers to meet your expectations, if you can work hard to meet their expectations, then these individual cases, the microeconomics of the law, they get resolved in a fair, orderly, and predictable manner. And when you add them all up, you know, the macroeconomics of the law, then hopefully what you get within your community is kind of a seamless, predictable form of justice. But it doesn't mean that lawyers won't agree with you. You may, as a judge, have a position with regard to child support, parental supervision, alimony, how you interpret a contract that they disagree with. But as long as you're consistent in the application of those ideas, they will live with that. They'll consult with clients. They'll accurately predict results, and then they can resolve disputes. And the vast majority of disputes have to be resolved short of trial. And we talk about this as a trial court, which when you look at the staggering number of cases that go through here and the total number of days available in any given year to have trials, it's the failure of negotiation, the failure of settlement, the failure of motion practice. Those are the cases that end up going to trial. Everything else will ultimately be resolved by the attorneys and the parties.
In your retirement letter, you also said goodbye to what you called the liars, haters, manipulators, takers, and other evildoers.
And they know who they are.
I
know who they are. And there have been a lot of them, and there'll be more of them, and someone else can deal with them. So much of the legal disputes resolved in a trial court, as I've said, they're about bad judgment. Maybe you were greedy on a business deal. Maybe you got drunk and drove across the center line and hurt someone. Maybe you're trying to take advantage of what you think is a favorable clause in a contract. I mean, there's so many different ways that you can be excessive and greedy or show poor judgment, hurt someone you love. Domestic violence is all about that. And often the victim is a woman, and often she's more forgiving than she should be, and this will repeat itself. There's just a lot of bad judgment out there, and that's the people that I've tried to hold accountable. And at the same time, maybe I'm holding him accountable for his domestic violence. I'm trying to encourage her to get counseling, go to the Women's Resource Center. You know, the fact that he brought you flowers, that's not a new plan. They always do that. You need to, you know, understand the situation you're in, because things like domestic violence tend to escalate. Pushing and shoving gets to hitting, and then gets to hitting with a weapon. And I've had cases go all the way from simple domestic violence to attempted murder.
You know, you mentioned bad judgment, but I would imagine there have been many times in your courtroom where you've come across, you know, genuinely bad, evil-minded people, and you've sent some of them to prison. What is that? What does that feel like when you do that?
Well, I mean, it's always mixed emotions. I mean, the most evil individual that I remember, and it was brought to my attention again recently, was the worst incest case I ever had. Can you imagine? If you've grown up in a family where you loved your mother and father, and you look to them for protection and guidance, and go to your baseball games and show up at the school award show, but how can you put yourself in the position? Now you're a juror, and you're listening to this testimony about a guy who would make his daughters and his son perform oral sex on him at shotgun point, who would threaten, if they said anything, to bury their mother in the garden. He looked evil. He was evil. He did evil things. And so when you sentence someone like that, on one level, somewhat superficial level, there's some degree of satisfaction that now he's held accountable and he's going to go away and he can never hurt anyone again. But the greater feeling, the overwhelming feeling, is just sadness for these children. That, you know, the prosecutors in all three counties have been good in my entire tenure at getting folks into counseling and trying to help them. But you know that kids in a situation like that, they are climbing an uphill mountain. And the little boy in that case, I would sentence years later for physically abusing, not sexually, his own children. And so the counseling on that point had failed. To see that sort of thing recycled is disappointing.
Were there times where you had to sentence someone and you felt bad about it?
Oh, absolutely. Clarence Gomery.
Really?
I knew Clarence from the day he came to town as a judge. I had seen him in his private practice appearing in court. I had seen him as a prosecuting attorney in Leelanau County. I had met his wife, who was a lovely person, and to see Clarence, the bad part of Clarence, the part that was not being honest with his clients, to see that spiral into an attempt at murder, and then to have to sentence him, Clarence got a fair sentence. He did what he did. But I took no joy in that.
You also said in your letter, you mentioned people in government who would run roughshod over the public. And that made me think right away of, you know, fairly recently when you used pretty strong language when you vacated the permit for a 9-story building in Traverse City. And you used the words hopelessly naive, talking about the city commission when they were gathering information about that project. What was it about that case that prompted such a strong reaction from you? I think some people were kind of taken aback by what you said.
I couldn't believe that they were doing what they were doing in a fashion that seemed to be absolutely oblivious to the financial consequences associated with it, and to have no understanding of such basic terms associated with public service. Like, what is infrastructure? Do you not realize that infrastructure is a street? It's a curb. It's a street light. It's the tree lawn between the curb and the sidewalk. If you want to put in a river walk, that's infrastructure, water mains, sewer mains, the police and fire that support the security and public safety within it. That's all infrastructure. And then to say, well, geez, we're not contributing any public money. Do you have any idea what brownfield money is? Do you people know what tax increment financing is? Have you even had a cursory look at a I don't expect you to be lawyers, but a summary of the act? Do you realize what the public disclosures are that are mandated by the act? And to sit there and to make these decisions and to seem to be oblivious to the fact that there are 23, I believe, other pre-approved brownfield sites in this city and have no discussion of what the long-term financial consequences are, let alone the superficial, in my view, bizarre notion that to make Traverse City a better place, we need to subsidize parking spots for luxury condominiums. I mean, this is so far removed from the Biederman and Hagerty decks that are publicly owned and paid for by TIF money. It is so far removed from the original streetscapes proposal that was passed and put into place when I was mayor. That was a special assessment district. Folks paid their property taxes, and they paid extra to have this work done downtown, to turn the downtown around, to make it vital. Those were all wonderful things, and people paid their fair share. And now we've morphed into this corporate welfare with no discussion of it. You know, if they want to have the discussion that I've suggested they should have, that any, I think, common sense person with an interest in public service would want to have, and then they decide that, fine, we know we've got these brownfield, it's millions of dollars, it'll be decades before we get that money back, but, you know, we're aware of all that, and we decide we want to do this. That's fine. That's democratic. That's the political process. But they're blundering along doing these things with no seeming understanding of what the financial consequences are. When I look at this kind of money being spent, and I don't know, the city manager wanting to hire a forester when there are still water mains and sewer mains that are antiquated and need to be replaced, where there are city streets that need to be repaved, we still have, a mile or two of, maybe that's a little long, a number of unpaved alleys in the city of Traverse City. For crying out loud, get a grip, make a list, have priorities, talk about these things, encourage public comment, encourage public discussion. To listen to one commissioner say, we aren't doing enough for the people who aren't here, wake up. There are a lot of people who live in the city of Traverse City. They pay incredibly high taxes for the privilege of living there. They pay three to four times the taxes of neighboring Garfield Township. When you go into Garfield Township, you feel less safe, you feel less secure. What is the marginal justification for that tax rate to live on one side of the city limits as opposed to the other? And if you can justify it, that's great. But they aren't having this conversation. They are hopelessly naive or incompetent. And I think it's naive. These are not stupid people.
You know, you've mentioned frequently the community and that the court is part of the community. And, you know, I would imagine that being a judge is maybe a little bit like being a news reporter in that, you know, you can't help but feel like part of the community. And that means you have your own thoughts on things and your own opinions. But you also, you know, have kind of a firewall where you have to separate that from your professional work. Is that true when you're a judge and things like this?
Like, and being a monk.
Sometimes.
Different judges do handle it differently. But honestly, in my case, it was a difficult initial transition. I was at one time incredibly involved and active in this community, and I enjoyed that. But as you become a judge and you have to separate yourself, you have to make decisions, and sometimes people don't like them. What I found over the years was I was socially withdrawing. I wasn't active in the chamber anymore. I wasn't active in Rotary anymore. I wasn't in a position where I could write a letter to the editor or a forum article unless it was on a kind of a neutral subject anymore. I couldn't do those things.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, obviously I have opinions. I think anybody who is a lawyer or a judge who cares about their community, who keeps up on what things are happening, has opinions about them. But I think, you know, my opinions and others are always shaped, and I find this in court, by opinions that are different and the arguments that others make. I've told lawyers for years, I don't go into a sentencing unprepared. I don't go into a sentencing not knowing what I plan to do. But do I change? Absolutely. Because once you get there and then you hear a different spin or a different slant, or you look the defendant in the eye and the defendant is connecting with you and saying something that actually seems to make sense and resonates, you'll change. And so that's why I get upset about this lack of meaningful public debate and quite frankly, the lack of meaningful competition for local offices. It's that debate. It's the point counterpoint of ideas that should shape the policy and discussion that should allow people to change or shape their views and move forward with some sort of consensus that makes the community better. When you look at this on a national stage where nobody can agree with anybody on anything or reach any kind of consensus, that kind of paralysis of democracy isn't healthy. And that's at the macro level. This works when you begin locally. All politics is local. Democracy is best locally. And if things are working well locally, that then percolates up. It doesn't start from the top and go down. So not having candidates for city commission, not having candidates for county commission, not having viable public debate, not shaping and reshaping positions based on listening to each other and having intelligent argument, you get to the point where you find yourself providing long-term tax subsidies to some downstate guy's $500,000 condo so he has a place to park his BMW. I mean, seriously.
Does the job ever get to you? You know, what I mean is you are a community-minded person, but yet, you know, I can imagine it might be hard for you. You might be out at the grocery store and there's somebody who was in your courtroom and didn't like a decision you made or something that you said. Do you get blowback from people? Is it hard for you to be out in public sometimes?
It's hard, but not for that reason. In my experience, and I would surely recommend this to my successor, if you're straight with people, if you explain to them when you're sentencing what you're doing and why, you know, at the state level, they talk about proportionality, whether you're sentenced in Escanaba or Detroit or Traverse City, same facts, same prior record, you should get substantially the same sentence. That's good, and that makes sense. But the acid test for me is, can four guys go back in their cell and talk about their sentences and have them make sense to each other? And I make a real effort to make sure people understand what they're being sentenced for and why. I reward candor. I don't suffer fools lightly. And over the years, what I've discovered, because I every morning, practically, I'm walking through the lower level of the courthouse where probationers and parolees are having their report day, and I have never had a problem. They speak to me, I speak to them, we catch up on how everybody's doing. I've had people thank me in the parking lot for sending them to prison because it finally was what they needed to wake them up. So that hasn't been the problem. The thing that becomes emotionally overwhelming after a while is watching people who almost invariably, the vast majority of felons that I sentence, come from these chaotic, dysfunctional, one-parent families. They're characterized generally by alcohol abuse or some other form of substance abuse. There's often an overlay of physical abuse and, more often than not, sexual abuse. Do they act out? Absolutely. Do I now see them at as early as 17 and maybe still at 32 to 35 committing crimes? Yes. They need to be held accountable, but I get where they came from. You know, I can walk into any elementary school in these three counties today, and you let me look at the files, and I can tell you who's at risk. But we don't have the resources to deal with all those at-risk kids. So you hold them accountable, you put them on probation, you try to get them the services, and you hope that maybe somehow while they're on probation, they can learn the things that maybe two responsible parents might have taught them at home. And it is frustrating. My father was an elementary school principal and often worked in schools with these kids. And I have the same compassion for them that he did.
I want to take you back a few years and ask you about the Meyer case. You kind of got into the middle of that fight over the Meyer.
No. I got at the front end and I lived with it for 12 years.
This is about, of course, the Meyer store in Acme Township. It was a long, drawn-out, volatile situation. At one point, you accused one of Meyer's attorneys of lying to you about his involvement in the company's illegal campaign to oust the township board. Can you take me back and tell us what happened?
Well, I mistook which attorney it was, and then it would later turn out that he had been involved, and that was the basis of settlements later. You know, I think it was just, it was something I believed that I probably shouldn't have said. It was born out of frustration, and I publicly apologized for it.
And but the guy was eventually cleared by the attorney discipline board, right?
I don't know that they held that in abeyance for a long, long time. He did admit the things that he did with regard to the elections out there. I don't know whether or not he was cleared by the attorney discipline board. He may have been. I think that was a difficult thing for this community to see, that sort of scorched earth policy with regard to development, where the developer, Meyer, the owner of the land, I think Smith, would actually go to the lengths of suing individual town board members. That's not the way things had been done here before. That's not the way things have been done here since. I think it was a disaster for Meyer. I don't know how much broccoli they're going to have to sell out there before they ever begin to break even on the millions of dollars they spent on legal fees, the millions of dollars they spent on settlements, the millions of dollars of lost sales from the years this thing pended while they were fighting about where the gas station was going to be located or what the outside of the building was going to look like. It was a harsh lesson in development, but it wasn't the first. When I was elected in 1990 in November, the first hearing in the Grand Traverse Mall case occurred, and Judge Brown denied an injunction to stop the construction. And that was intense litigation for the next year. And ultimately, the mall was built, and ultimately, the environmental issues were addressed. And traffic circulation and traffic patterns. But what mostly came out of that litigation, and what I think is the lesson that came out of the Meyer litigation, is township government needs to be open, it needs to be transparent, it needs to post its meeting notices, it needs to be honest with the public about what it's doing and why it's doing it, and township government needs to be held accountable too. I mean, I remember being critical of them at one point. You're holding Meyer to a standard of exterior design that will be promulgated in a book that hasn't been written yet. I mean, really? How is anyone supposed to be able to move forward with any sort of, whether it's a residential or commercial development, if it has to comply with a design book and you haven't even written the standards yet? I mean, it doesn't even make sense. So, you know, I think the lessons that come out of those are typically about government processes, transparency, and to be consistent.
Was being a judge a calling for you when you were a kid? Did you know that's what you wanted to be someday?
Being a lawyer was. I was either going to be a lawyer or follow my father into education. And honestly, the 1st and 15th of every month in my house wasn't an argument, but it was a discussion of getting the bills paid. And my mother didn't work outside the home in those days. My father was as I said, an elementary school principal. My grandfather was in care, and Medicare didn't come along until the year he died. So, you know, money was tight, and I didn't want to have a discussion on the 1st and 15th of every month of which bills were going to be paid, so I ultimately chose the path of the law. And my great-grandfather had been a prosecuting attorney in Kent County, had read law in Maine and moved to Michigan in 1880, and my great uncle, his oldest son, had gone to University of Michigan Law School and been a lawyer in Grand Rapids, and they were always held in high esteem in the family. So that was something that I thought I really would like to do. I grew up in an era of social change. You know, we were baby boomers. We were going to change the world and make it better. Arguably, that hasn't worked out so well. But, you know, public service was something that I thought was important. And my father-in-law, who I absolutely adored and everybody respected, was one of the greatest trial judges in the state's history, William Peterson from Cadillac. And he was an incredible mentor. But becoming a judge is kind of like deer hunting. You know, you need to be in the right place at the right time, or it's just, you can't plan on it. If I thought I would only be happy as a judge, I'm a pretty conservative person, I probably wouldn't have gone to law school, because the odds of that just are difficult. I mean, look at me. I've been here 26 years. If you were a lawyer and you're in Traverse City and you thought you wanted to be a judge someday, how frequently does that opportunity even arise? And then you've got to compete against it with other people. So I love doing it. It's wonderful public service. But the calling was to be a lawyer.
What makes this the right time for you to retire?
Well, as I told others, I've been thinking about this for a while. I almost didn't run again last time. But the equation that I've been dealing with is, I like being a judge. I enjoy the challenge. There are mundane parts of it that I don't like. There are administrative parts of it that aren't really why I went to law school, but I've risen to those challenges. But I've always thought, you know, there's time. There's time to do the things that I wanted, other things that I want to do. But you get to a certain point in life where you realize you've got way more past than you do future. And as I told someone else, the question for me now isn't how long will I live. Maybe I will break the records in my family and live to be 95, and somebody will be changing my diaper and feeding me applesauce somewhere. Great. But what I'm concerned with is, how many years do my wife and I both have where we both can be healthy and productive and do other things? And, you know, once you get to my age, I'm 64 in a couple of weeks, that window's starting to close. My mother, who's still alive, told me, you know, you be careful, son, because once you get to be 80, you start to fall apart. And maybe it was a self-fulfilling prophecy, because the poor lady turned 80 and she's had a lot of medical problems ever since. She now calls them her medical years, not her golden years. So there's a window there. And I've provided public service. I'm not complaining about the compensation, but I have gone 16 years without any kind of raise. So to me, it is public service. I'm not getting rich doing this, but there are other things I'd like to do. And the time has finally come to do that. I've got a great staff. I have a wonderful relationship with Judge Power. Everything we've done here, we've done together. We've been innovative, I think. We've been progressive. We've really tried to bring this court into the 21st century. But right now, I've run out of projects here, and I got a lot of personal ones I'd like to work on. I'm building a pole barn down in Lake County.
Really?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, there you go. That'll occupy quite a bit of your time.
You know, I think, honestly, if I hadn't become a judge, I would have loved being a general contractor.
Yeah?
I like the logistics. I like the organization. I like pulling all the pieces together. And when you finish, you have a tangible product that you've created that you can see. As a judge, you know you're trying to make things better, but often it's very difficult to see if you're actually having an impact. You know what the best thing of retirement has been? I've been living Jimmy Stewart's life for the last 2 days. Remember the movie, It's a Wonderful Life?
Yeah.
That's my last 2 days.
So you mean by that people are coming forward and you're seeing some of the positive impact that you've had in your career?
Yeah.
Well, that's nice. That's good. Judge Philip Rogers, pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
I've enjoyed it very much. You guys take care.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.